welcome to episode 64 of the Narrative Wargamer Podcast. I am Tony Rhodes, and tonight I'm joined once again by Mr. Jonathan Sharpie.
Good evening.
And by Darren Wright.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome again. It's been a little while since we've had you on the show, Darren.
I don't know. I think the last time was one of the lore questions. I think that was the last time I was on.
Yes, our Tyrannic War lore quiz was the last time we had you on. It's always fun. But it's nice to have you on one of our sort of other mainline episodes as well. So welcome to everyone who is watching this on YouTube or listening to us on their podcasting platform of choice. Tonight is we're going to have a little bit of a catch up where we're all at in the hobby at the moment and sort of things we've been doing, because there's been just generally quite a little bit of hustle and bustle in the 40k community at the moment in the last couple of weeks. There's lots of things going on, lots of little things to talk about since we last got together. And of course, we will later in the episode be talking about the new Crusade Pariah Nexus book, because we've now got our hands on a copy. I've had it for about a week now, and I've had a chance to sort of go through it all. And it's just a good chance now to have a little review of it and talk about it as a group. For those of you who have been following the channel over on YouTube, you may have seen that I've already put up a small sort of quick summary review video that I did sort of by myself. And there's some sort of an overview of the book there, but hopefully tonight we can all have a nice little chat about it and talk a bit more in depth about some of the interesting aspects in it.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that, like I said. Been playing a lot of, I haven't been playing much narrative games at the moment, so I think something like this will definitely be a bit more inspiration for that, you know.
So I'm really interested to see what they've done, because obviously this is their first standalone Crusade DLC, isn't it? Obviously we had what was in the Leviathan box and in the rule book that was then released as a separate book, but this is the first time they've done something new, so I'm really interested to see what they're adding into the game.
Yeah, there's some nice new sort of additions to Crusade elements that we're familiar with. There's some new concepts in there as well. A interesting selection of missions, as always. And this at the moment is kind of like the latest quality of life check for Crusade, if that makes sense. As is often the case with a lot of GW publications like this, the sort of the unwritten implication is often that the latest version or latest release of something is the most up-to-date official version of it, because there might be some minor tweaks or adjustments to some elements of the systems from previous versions.
Yeah.
For example, I know if you're starting a Crusade using the Pariah Nexus rules in here, the standard Crusade rule suggests starting with 10 requisition points as opposed to 5, which is what traditionally has been the case. Certainly in 9th edition. I can't remember if the Tyrannic War book might have updated it to 10 or not, but just some small changes like that in it and stuff like that, sort of quality of life changes. We'll get into those a bit later, but before that, like you say, let's all have a little catch up about everything that's been going on in 40k recently and what we've all been up to. So Darren, you mentioned you've actually had the opportunity to be playing fairly regularly recently, but some more sort of competitive scene stuff?
Yeah. So I did a local RTT midweek, 3 games in a day. Ended up taking second place, but I think... and then at the weekend did a team event, which was a 2-day, GT style. And it's been very structured, just how to score the most points to win a game kind of play, and not much narrative. But we did do a campaign with my friends that do kind of more narrative play. In 9th, ended it with a big huge game, and then we're now gonna start, now we've got to terms with the rules of 10th, I think we're going to start like leaning more into the more like narrative play again. Somebody started a whole new army bringing Necrons. So the idea is that a tomb world has been discovered, under in one of the planets in the solar system we've been playing anyway. And the Necrons are now the big bad threat. So
nice.
Forward to that.
Well, maybe Crusade Prime Nexus might be the go-to source of campaign stuff for you right there.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping. I think it's going to definitely bring some of that, I think.
And speaking of Necrons, I believe, Sharpie, you finally had a chance to actually rock yours out for a few games after the Codex dropped the other month.
Yeah, it took a while. So I took them to a tournament at Element Games. I say a tournament. It's a friendly day, King of the North tournament. Three games, 1250 points. There's some sort of restrictions on what you can take, so that not everybody brings super competitive choices. I played three games. I won two on the day. The last game was just to turn up and shoot your opponent. And kill everything type game, which I've always struggled with Necrons, because they're not always the killiest. But yeah, that was a good day. And then I also had Dan Redtooth. He came to play a game the other week with his Tyranids, and I played with my Necrons and I beat him with that one. He brought the Vanguard detachment to that one, and then he also came back a second time, and because the Necrons felt a little bit good at the minute, I played with my demons, and he brought the Endless Swarm, and that was a cracking game, and he beat me quite convincingly in that one. So yeah, so I've had a fair few games recently.
Nice. And how have you been finding the demons in 10th edition? Interesting. Certainly, they're an unusual faction.
Yeah, I really enjoy playing with them. I haven't mastered them yet is the best way. I think I've played four or five times with them, and I don't think I've won a game with them yet. Really interesting to play. Haven't quite figured them out yet, but I think, you know, when you put the models down on the table and you have all the different gods and different colours on the table, I think they're one of the best looking armies that you can have in 40k. I just think it looks really nice when they're spreading out across the board, and so I always enjoy playing with them. I just haven't mastered the art of winning with them yet. Although I noticed that I got substantially more for my points this time after the recent update than I have in the past.
Yeah, there seems to have been a little bit of a leg up for demon players there, hasn't there? I mean, I know looking at the lists that I was putting together just from my collection of stuff that I've got that's painted, I basically can put in my third Beast of Nurgle now for no real additional cost.
Right, okay.
Which is nice.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the units that I'm struggling with most at the minute are Khorne, especially the Bloodletters. They just don't seem to be killy enough. I mean,
it depends what you're fighting against, because Bloodletters make exceptional Space Marine killers. And they are really almost perfectly positioned for that. But anything like more lightly target, like anything more lighter but more numerous, they just struggle to cut through. And anything a bit tougher than like your standard sort of power armored Space Marines, they tend to struggle to harm. So they're in an interesting place. I do think
they've not been able to trade very well with them, because the thing is, if they will die the next turn after they've attacked something. So struggle with them a little bit. But really enjoy playing with the demons. Great looking army. Waiting for the rules. Probably going to have to wait for another year and a bit, judging by the roadmap. But cracking. Necrons, definitely really enjoyable, but perhaps a little bit too good at the minute, dare I say.
We'll have to see how they do in the near future. And obviously they've had a sort of surprise spotlight thrown on them post LVO.
Yes, I would agree. They didn't get any changes either because it was a fairly new codex as well. So I suspect there's quite a few Necron players that were quite happy with that, with the status quo remaining.
Yeah, so obviously I didn't particularly follow the events of the LVO per se, but obviously everything sort of trickles down over Instagram and other places like Discord and so on. And the couple of days after the results, as it were, I kept seeing lots of memes about Necrons popping up with monoliths to spoil Eldar players' days.
I mean, it was brave, knowing that you have to make 2 6-up saves to stay alive. But you know, fortune favors the brave, doesn't it?
It does. So it's going to be interesting to see what we see in the near future. I mean, speaking of, obviously both me and Darren are excited for presumably upcoming orcs on the near horizon, because I think they are the next book in the roadmap, at least.
They said spring for them, definitely. It's definitely spring. I know Chaos have also said, they've said spring for Chaos too, so maybe it'll be orcs and Chaos. Possibly.
We'll have to see. I mean, I know we've been getting more and more reveals for the the upcoming Codex Crute.
Yeah.
Yes, that would suggest that Tau is not a million miles away.
What have you, either of you two thought about the sort of like Crute reveals and the new range of units that they're supposedly getting?
I mean, I think the models look great. I like the fact that they've redone old units and they've got some new units in there as well. And I hope that it changes the way that Tau players can play their army. Because, you know, they're hopefully going to have a viable option perhaps to get forward a little bit and maybe hit somebody rather than just stand back and shoot. And, you know, unfortunately, they have a reputation for not always playing the game in the way that other people would want, don't they? But they're kind of a bit hamstrung, really, because the crew, despite being in the codex, haven't really been good, certainly for the three editions I've been playing.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's really interesting to see the inclusion of the Crutox Riders as a unit, because that's pretty much legitimately the first dedicated melee unit in like the entirety of the Tau Codex for the majority of its existence.
Yes.
Like the Crute have always sort of occupied this weird middle ground where they're essentially still sort of like a light infantry unit with guns, which are a bit more fighty by Tau standards, but by wider 40k standards, they're nothing really more special than a Space Marine, you know, intercessor would be. And you wouldn't really consider them a melee unit.
Yeah, agreed.
But these Crutox Riders look like they are set to be the first proper melee threat that the Empire is going to bring to bear. So I think it'll be interesting to see how... I feel like their inclusion is going to have a very similar position to like Bulgrins in Guard.
Yes. Yeah, agreed. Just something a bit different to having three tanks at the back or shooting things as they come up the table.
Yeah, I think the models look great. I think they look. I've seen a lot of excitement for them from people that maybe like play Tau and stuff as well, which is cool. I think just having the option to be able to have a melee. I mean, I'm in the kind of the opposite boat of them with orcs. Probably the same.
Yeah,
it's like. Not having, I'm a pure melee army and I don't have any shooting. And it's like Tau seem to be a very shooty army, don't have any melee. And I think to balance both out is, and to just have an option to be able to do that, even if it's literally just like you have a gun line and then there's one that runs out and does some melee, maybe just holds back a wave or something. And I think it'll be a good option for the town.
I'm interested to see the first proper like mixed Tau Empire army on the table, because I know obviously a lot of people have been talking a bit about like there's enough Kroot units to make a Kroot army, you know, like,
yeah.
And they've said there is a detachment for Kroot, and like you've got all the requirements to take an army that is pure Kroot, and you don't have to have any Tau, and that's great and that's fine, you know. And I'm sure there are certainly there's a player base out there that will look forward to playing with their dedicated Kroot army, but similar to almost the way we were talking about the demons, Sharpie, I think it would be really interesting to see a Tau Empire army that has a proper mix of like Fire Warriors and Kroot and Ethereals and some tanks and battle suits and all the rest of it, and actually feel like you've got a Crisis team alongside Narlok Riders, and then you've got broadsides alongside the Heavy Gunner Narlok and so on.
That's how I would imagine the army would look good being played. Yeah, that the Kroot are a new, you know, tool in the toolbox that Tau players can bring in and use, you know, a bit more consistently, and adds a bit more flavour to their armies, so they don't have to continue just using the same old Tau units. I mean, I think they're great. And like you say, I've seen so many people who immediately just went down the lines of saying, "Oh, I can actually field a whole Kroot army now." I mean, there's a lot of love, isn't there, for the Kroot in general, even though I can't remember ever seeing Kroots on the battlefield anywhere where I've played.
The last time I saw Kroot models anyway was actually when I played in a Necromunda game where someone was using the Kroot kill team they were using the Venator rules. So basically they're like bounty hunters in terms of game mechanics, but that means they can look like anything. So we just have this, right, you know, Kroot hunting pack that were behaving as these, like this bounty hunter gang. And yeah, I mean, if you've been a dedicated Kroot fan, you know, for some time now, then between the upcoming new releases, the recent kill team set, and even like things like the tracker from Blackstone Fortress and so on.
Nice model that.
Yeah, there's started to be a slowly diversifying range of them for you to actually collect. So yeah, good times to be a Kroot fan, it would seem.
Yeah, I hope to see some sooner rather than later anyway.
Yeah, now all they really need, in my opinion, is a third significant racial faction to the Tau, and then they will feel like a proper coalition and not just an alliance of like Tau and Kroot.
Yeah, I've heard people saying about that, like they need to bring, like, bring in one of the other races that are part of the Tau Empire.
Not expecting any Vespin models then.
I mean, I think they could do some amazing stuff with sculpting technology these days for some sort of proper, like, in-flight Vespid.
Yeah.
Imagine if they got something that was more sort of like ogre-sized big insectoid unit.
Yeah. I mean, it almost feels a shame that now that they've sorted the Kroot out, that they've not mentioned anything about the Vespids, because, I mean, they're in the Codex, aren't they? Well, I'm fairly sure they're still in the Codex. They've got some pretty old models, I know, but I think they would add something different to the army as well.
I mean, I know one of the elements that, like, people in the know with their Tau lore would love to see on the tabletop is the Nicatar, which is like the psychic polar bears.
All right.
They're one of the other like major client races of the Tau Empire, because they're one of their main like psychically attuned auxiliary races, but they're essentially sort of like these bear-like creatures. think almost a bit like what they called? It's sort of like the Banthas in Star Wars, or the flying bison in Last Airbender, if ever you've seen those.
I have, yes.
I haven't seen Airbender, but obviously Star Wars. But I have heard someone describe them as like an owl bear from like D&D a little bit.
With
like
that sort of thing. But yeah, these sort of like psychic bears, because they essentially play the role in their society of being a bit like navigators in the Imperium. Because they, as a species, they are quite like starfaring and, you know, all about traveling and navigating space. But they would both be a really interesting model concept, and they would obviously bring a psychic element to the Tau Codex, which is obviously an element it's currently lacking.
Oh, I don't know. Back in the old day, the Maelstrom cards for the Tau still had the denied psychic power as one of the actual physical cards you could draw. Seemed a bit harsh at the time.
Well, I mean, you had to deal with that as well as a Necron player. Now, technically, you could do it, but it was still not very commonplace for you to achieve it.
Yeah, you had to get that Gloom Prism in the right place, didn't you?
Yeah. But yeah, it'd be interesting. You know, hopes for future Xenos races, as always. I'm still waiting for my species of knight-sized Xenos monsters.
Am I right in thinking the Tau have something like that, where it's like there's a race that were like fairly big, but they were like generally like a peace-loving race, and then the Tau came in and persuaded them to join?
I can't remember. Again, deep like lore, Tau lore.
They're like a giant worm or something, I think.
I can't remember if that might have been the Poctroons. Because they were the first alien race that the Tau encountered and successfully brought into the fold of the greater good. But within like two generations, they were all unfortunately died out, and their species became extinct.
Not so great a good for them.
Well, that's the point. When you get into the real sort of like questionable Tau lore, as it were, like the questionables in terms of ethics and motives, and obviously everything that they are still trying to achieve as an expanding interstellar empire. The Poctroons had quite some resource-rich worlds in their thriving little empire, and then obviously they've very quickly contributed all those assets and resources to the Tau Empire, and oh, what are we going to do with all those resources when the Poctroons unfortunately die out? Well, I guess they don't need them anymore.
They're greater good.
Speaking of other mysterious races and things that they're getting up to in the galaxy, we have, of course, the Pariah Nexus. The latest master plan of the Silent King and his race of mechanical monstrosities, some might say.
And some would argue that that's not fair.
don't get me wrong, Chappie. You know I like Necron Lord as much as any other race. I find them fascinating. And I very much agree that they are, in some ways, probably the true inheritors of the galaxy.
Yeah, and they're just coming back to clean up, like, the mess. The way I see it is, they're like two parents that they went out on a Saturday night and they left their teenage children on their own, and they trusted them not to mess up, and they're turning up and they've got a horrendous mess in the house to clean up, and they're just having to sort it out in the good old-fashioned way. Okay? Clearing up the mess of all those young races that have just fouled up massively in their absence. They're just really, really, really misunderstood.
I recently just finished Infinite and Divine, and I think it's one of the best 40k books I've read as well. I really enjoyed that book.
I think that book is probably the book, if somebody ever said to me, what's all this Warhammer stuff about? And I said, well, you know, I'd probably give them that book and say, you need to read this because this is probably what sums up 40k, you know, in a nutshell. It's an absolutely brilliant book, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't think I've come across anybody that's read it who hasn't agreed.
Definitely gave me a new love for the Necrons, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty universally loved by the community, isn't it? And like I say, I've read it as well. It's great. And we've mentioned it before on the podcast. If you haven't read it, go check it out. It's highly advised. And yeah, I think you're right, Chappie. I think it would make a fascinating read for someone who is not familiar with 40K to be introduced to the different settings, environments, factions, and races involved in that book.
Yeah, you know, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's great in the fact that it introduces so many different races, and you know, if you're in the hobby, you'll recognize Gene Steel of Cult, Eldari, Space Marines, Orcs. Imperial Guard, but you know, they don't necessarily name it by name. And so actually, like, if somebody was new to the hobby, that might be enough to intrigue them to perhaps step in and see a little bit more. Great book.
In addition to that, also another good book is Prime Nexus. to sort of jump into this then, this is the latest Crusade release, a book, supplement, expansion, whatever you want to call it, from Games Workshop. So this is, it's not core or essential to playing in your latest version of 10th edition rules. As such, this is sort of like the latest version of the Crusade rules. And if you didn't pick up a copy of the Leviathan box set, or you obviously just are new to the hobby since its release, then Prior Nexus might be one of the first times you have an opportunity to see or pick up the core Crusade rules. So we've been over sort of the concepts and core elements of Crusade a few times now on the podcast, as we've done these books and reviews over the years. But it essentially just gives us a little bit of the latest updated version of it all. As I said, there's some minor updates, things like an increased starting number of requisition points. There's obviously updated 10th edition language for things like picking enhancements for characters, and a few options for upgrading your units to legendary status, rearming and re-equipping units, increasing supply limits, all the sort of core mechanics of Crusade. So we won't dive into that too much here. I'd say you can either go back and listen to some of our previous Crusade episodes throughout the podcast's history, or in the near future, I will be putting out a How to Play Crusade video here on YouTube. So keep your eyes peeled for that if you would like a bit of a rundown of how it all mechanically works and some of my suggestions for the best way to get some quality of life improvements out of the system. One of the notable little additions in here compared to the Tyrannic War book is the inclusion of a battle trait table for monsters and vehicle units. It was sort of surprisingly lacking from the Tyrannic War book, because the whole sort of like sub Crusade system in that book was about monster hunters and monsters. So there wasn't just like a single battle trait table for them. So I do think this covers all the bases now, because we've got battle traits for character units, monsters and vehicle units, infantry units, one specifically for mounted units, which I can't remember whether or not that was included in Tyrannic War or not. I don't remember it.
I don't think I remember that, actually, no.
No.
Yeah. There's some interesting upgrades in here. Yeah, so As with all battle traits, which are the some of the upgrades that your units can gain as they progress in ranks throughout your crusade. Some examples of the mounted unit upgrades in here, you've got Riders of Ruin, which is just +2 inch to movement characteristics. Nice. Thundering Onslaught, +1 to advance and charge. Saddleborn Assassins was an interesting one. Each time a model in this unit makes a ranged attack that targets the closest eligible target, improve the armor penetration characteristic of that attack by one.
That could be quite nice.
It is, yeah. To say it's obviously it's a ranged sort of like upgrade for mounted units. So things like your what are your ranger bike riders called, Sharpie?
Shroud runners.
Yeah, that's the one.
Is that right? Shroud runners.
Yeah. I think it's shroud runners.
I'm just thinking that'd be really good with orc war bikes as well.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Orc war bikes. The orc war bikes already have. They have no AP, but it's 1 AP if you're in half range, so that'd make it 2 AP, which would be really nice, since bikers have just been very shooty as they used to be in 10th.
Yeah, and then you've got line breakers, which basically turns everybody into orcs. Because it's a, if you complete a charge move, then all your melee weapons gain sustained hits one.
Nice.
Oh, that's nice.
I won't be taking.
There's a crushing charge, which is basically the thing that blood crushers have. So once you finish a charge move, you roll a d6 for each model in your unit, and on a 4+, you inflict a mortal wound on the enemy.
That's really nice. I had that done to me by blood crushers, so nice to do it back.
And then a blur of speed for your Ravenwing fans, because this is models in the unit gain stealth because they just move that fast.
They sound great. They sound really good. Because I'm trying to think of them like I'm using a couple of mounted units, bikes, Squigog boys. So being able to have stealth on Squigog boys would make them like even tougher, I think, because they're already quite tanky.
Yeah, for what they are, they're one of the sort of like toughest units around at the moment, aren't they? In terms of like mobility and damage output and points value, as it were. They're pretty good all round units at Squidcog Riders at the moment. And then, yeah, as always, I say there's a whole bunch of other options for other units. But we do, of course, as always, have a selection of very interesting Crusade relics. And the podcast is an opportunity for us to go through some of these in particular and go through some of the interesting options therein. So we've got, as always, Artificer Relics, Antiquity Relics, and Legendary Relics. I'll just read through a couple of names. You can both pick one and I can tell you what interesting things they do. So, Sharpie, you can pick first from the Artificer Relics. We have either the Blackstone Compass, the Veil of Ancients, the Treasure of the Technomandrites, or the Armor of the Soulless Sentry?
Oh, well, we're going to have the Treasure of the Technomandrites.
Okay. So I'll give you a little bit of lore stuff on this as well, because they are interesting. So, legitimized anew by Cesaric's patronage, the rogue cryptechs known as the Technomandrites, so possibly interesting new discipline of technomancer there.
Ooh, awesome.
Have wasted no time in fashioning and unleashing terrifying new weapons. Some of these, lost amidst the carnage on blazing battlefields, have since been scavenged by many warring factions. So you select one weapon equipped by the bearer, excluding an enhancement or a weapon-modified weapon, and then select one of the abilities below for that weapon to gain. That weapon is now a Crusade relic. Note this on the Bearer's Crusade card, and give that weapon a suitable name, is an actual instruction.
Okay.
So make sure you're always giving suitably impressive names for your Crusade weapons. And basically, yeah, your melee weapon gains either lethal hits, precision hits, or sustained hits one.
Okay. That's nice. Nice that you can choose.
Yeah, and that is it's a weapon as well. It doesn't have to be a melee weapon. It could just be a weapon wielded by the bearer.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, so lots of interesting options there. So Darren, what do you want to hear about? Compass, veil, or armor?
I'll go for the compass.
The Blackstone Compass.
Which crazed engineer fashioned this esoteric device of brass and wires is unknown. There is no denying, however, that the strange contraption's shrilling note indicates deposits of Noctilith near at hand. So this is after you win a battle, if the bearer is on the battlefield, you gain two additional Blackstone fragments, which we will get onto in a little bit, because collecting Blackstone fragments is essentially the new Crusade mechanic for a Pariah Nexus campaign. So this is going to sort of help you do that even better.
Nice.
Can I just say as well, before we move on, you know the one that Sharpie just chose? I love that it's like, give it a name, and it doesn't have to be necessarily a melee weapon. Because I know people who've already created characters, and their character is like, in the fluff, he's like very shooty. So if you can make his gun even better, it would just add more to the character that they've built. I think Crusade, for anyone who's not played Crusade before, it's a really good element for like making fluffy armies, new characters, things like that. And I think just giving them this kind of new weapon that they get to choose the name is just another thing that lets people add their own kind of fluff and their own flavor to their army, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning. It's worth mentioning that one of my favorite things to do is using the weapon modifications, like battle traits that you can get, where you pick a weapon and you give it 2 stat increases. I like using that on my characters to make their like non-primary weapons more interesting. So, for example, my Orc Warboss in Mega Armor, I don't need to be upgrading his big chopper with, like, you know, extra damage or AP or attacks or whatever, because it's probably going to do reasonable work anyway. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, certain weapons and certain characters, if you are going to give them +1 to hit or +1 damage or whatever, that's where they'll start to get a little bit broken and be a little bit over the top.
Yeah.
But if you suddenly look at taking that big shooter on his shoulder that's got the grot firing it, that thing becomes really entertaining and useful without being broken if suddenly it's got a point of AP and it's damaged 2. You know, like then it becomes the boss's custom shooter, and that's just like a really fun little gadget for him to, you know, crack out and take down a few targets with and just have a good time with. But it doesn't feel like you're like overpowering your character for the sake of making him the biggest and deadliest thing you could possibly be. You're not min-maxing him.
Yeah, I think I remember doing something quite similar with my Warboss on bike in 9th. I think I gave him a pistol, but it was like a D3 damage pistol, something like that. And it was like, it was a lot of the game. I already had the Killer Claw or whatever. He already had really killy combat, but then sometimes he'd end up stuck in combat. So just giving him a pistol where he could, like, while that just pull out his other arm, shoot someone as well, and an extra element that he didn't have was like really nice to add that he didn't break the unit.
Yeah, it's fair to say that the legendary relic pistols did not make the transition from 9th edition to 10th. They did not factor into the new enhancements system, so perhaps using weapon modifications on your like character's sidearms is that fun way of bringing back unique relic pistols for people.
Yeah.
Always fun when you pull them out and they pull off an amusing shot to take out an enemy character, or end up taking the last wounds off that Imperial Knight or something. Right, so antiquity relics. Back to you, Sharpie. We have choice of the Noctilith Sigil, the Dolem Key, Van Takren's Mirror, or the Eye of Mars.
Ooh, let's go with the Eye of Mars.
This frumming fist-sized device entered the war zone upon a servo talk by Auspictratix Magna Olam, subsequently seized as a trophy when it was cut from Olam's neck along with his head. Its powers of strategic tactical early warning remain undimmed. So this is, by the sounds of it, some servo skull, or now a servo skull anyway, of some unfortunate tech priest,
After both players have deployed their armies, select one unit from your Crusade army and redeploy it. When doing so, you can set that unit up in strategic reserves if you wish, regardless of how many units are already in strategic reserves.
Okay, that's a nice little relic.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice little redeploy relic. Darren, what do you want?
I'll go for the mirror, I think.
Van Cheren's mirror. This sinister device was brought from the deepest vaults of Dantrius III by Major Skafar. Rumoured to be a relic of Old Night, it warps the real space presence of its bearer and nearby allies, confusing enemy sensors in a most unnatural fashion. Rumours that the bearer slowly fades from reality altogether may be lent some credence by the unexplained disappearance of Karth and his entourage. So, yeah, sounds like a piece of phasing technology where you eventually phase out entirely. models in the bearer's unit have the stealth ability. In addition, each time the bearer's unit is selected as a target of a charge, subtract 2 from the charge roll.
Oh, that's nice.
Because they're not there. Not anymore, anyway. And then finally, we have 3 legendary relics. We have the Blade of the Dynast, the Noctic Shield, or the Rod of the Omnisire.
Ooh, the Noctic Shield sounds fun.
The description of it is hilarious. I was hoping you might pick this one.
Yeah.
It is unclear which warring faction, although I have a feeling it might be the orcs when you hear this. Fashioned this seemingly crude and unwieldy shield. Anti-gravitic micro-suspensors counteract the weight of what is essentially a worked slab of noctolith, laced through with esoteric circuitry and fluctuating between empirically polarized states. The defensive properties of the Noctic Shield cannot be gainsaid, however, for it both wards away projectiles and blades with kinetic pulses, even as it drains the will and strength of those who assail its bearer. So yeah, it's just a big slab of blackstone with a few anti-grav motors in it to help keep it up.
Nice. Yeah, that definitely sounds orky.
Sounds orky indeed.
Add 1 to the toughness and wounds characteristics of the bearer. Once per battle, when an attack targets the bearer's unit, if your crusade army is in the defensive strategic footing, which is another thing we will get to shortly, the bearer can activate this crusade relic. If it does so until the end of the phase, each time an attack is allocated to a model in the bearer's unit, subtract 1 from the damage characteristic of that attack.
Oh, that's nice. So plus 1 wound, plus 1 toughness all the time, and then potentially minus 1 damage.
For one phase of the game, yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's nice.
And again, I love the idea of the modelling opportunities for this. Basically, imagine like an orc war boss with one of the Silent King's menhirs, just like smashed in half and used as a shield.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That's basically what this is. And then we have the Blade of the Dynast or the Rod of the Omnisire.
We'll go with the Blade of the Dynast.
This is a flowing and many-formed weapon sheathed in living metal and powered by a shard of a captive star. So this is the Necron equivalent of a demon weapon, except it's got a katarn locked in it instead.
Nice. One for you, Jonathan.
Oh, yes. Sounds cool.
It was forged for use by Necron dynastic champions to wield in honor jewels whose outcome could, by triarchal code, decide the fate of worlds. So this one is, improve the strength, damage, and armor penetration characteristics of the bearer's melee weapons by 1. And once per battle in your charge phase, if your crusade army is in the aggressive strategic footing stance, which again, we'll get to in a minute, the bearer can activate this crusade relic. If it does so until the end of the phase, add 2 to the charge rolls made for the bearer's unit.
I really like that.
Yep, that sounds pretty nasty.
And +2 to charge is always nice.
Yeah, so I think it'll be worth talking briefly now about the strategic footings system, because we've mentioned it once or twice there in a couple of the relics, and it's worth just jumping over to it now. So basically, when you're playing any of the missions in this book, there's an additional step in the pre-battle sequence, which relates to the players determining their strategic footings. And what it basically means is you play like a mini game of rock, paper, scissors, based on secretly choosing to go into battle in either an aggressive, defensive, or balanced stance. And then there's a little table matrix of sort of like what that means based on what the two players have chosen when you reveal to each other what stance you've gone for. And based on that outcome, it determines a couple of things. One, it will actually determine who is going to be the attacker and defender for the mission. So, for example, if player A has chosen the aggressive stance and player B has chosen the defensive stance, then player B ends up being the defender and player A the attacker. You know, it makes sense, but you don't necessarily know what your opponent has chosen before you reveal that choice. So player A might have chosen to be aggressive, but if player B has also chosen to be aggressive, then you end up rolling off. So there's no guarantee that by picking aggressive you're going to be the attacker. But it does mean you're hedging your bets at trying to be the attacker, if that makes sense. And it's worth noting that in a lot of these missions we'll talk about in a bit, the first turn is often predetermined as to whether or not it is the attacker or defender who gets the first turn.
All right.
So that's why this has more weight and bearing on the outcome. And then the second thing it determines is whether or not one player or the other gets a strategic advantage, which basically means, again, in the missions coming up, each of them has a small bonus for whichever player has the strategic advantage. So, as an example, if player A chooses to be aggressive, then the outcomes, if player B is aggressive as well, then it's a roll-off for attacker and defender, and neither player has advantage. If player B chose a defensive stance, then player A will be the attacker, player B will be the defender, but the defender has the advantage because they chose to be defensive while taking an assault.
Yep.
If player B chose the balanced approach, then player A would be the attacker, but the attacker would gain the advantage because player B hasn't like committed to a defense against them. Mm-hmm. But the counterpoint to that is that if a player has chosen a balanced approach and their opponent chose a defensive approach, then the player who chose balanced, they would get to go first. So they would be the attacker and they would have the advantage.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because they're not in...
Yeah, they've got the tactical flexibility. To work around someone who's being defensive. So they say there's a whole little matrix table, and it's this fun extra little dynamic of, if nothing else, using this as an option to determine who's going to be attacker or defender when the two of you don't really mind or there isn't any obvious like narrative options from the armies and missions you're playing, then this gives you just that another option instead of just rolling off. And as I say, if you're playing these particular missions, it also has some bearing on first turn and tactical advantage. Which I will just, I will give you just like one example and just quickly. And we'll cycle back to missions in a bit. But for example, there's a mission called Polarizing Energies where there's four objective markers, but only two of them are active in any given battle round. So they're like the way they're paired off is you'll have one on either side of the battlefield is active, but it's one of two potential ones, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And after you've determined which ones start active, they flip every battle round. So that's just automatically going to happen. But if you're the player who's got the advantage for that mission, once per battle, you can choose for them to not flip that battle round.
Okay, that is quite advantageous then.
Yes. you, like you said, either you can hold your gains if you've got two really under your sway, or you could flip them if right now you don't have control and your opponent's got a good defensive setup for two of them.
That's a really nice little like new element in it. I think really.
Yeah,
it's like a little mini game at the start of the game, isn't it?
It is, and it'll only take like a minute to do, if that. You know, realistically, it's not a huge time sink. You both basically just either use a dice or write on a piece of paper on your phones or whatever. You know, if whether you want to be aggressive, balanced, or defensive, and then this little table tells you what that means. You know, who's going to be who, who's got what advantages, and whether or not you need to roll off the first turn. And what could be quite fun is escalating that in a campaign and doing it on like alliance based decisions. So if you had your local club night and you've got six or seven games going on across your two or three alliances, you could have the alliance pick a stance for that week, you know, or month or whatever, and everyone in that alliance will be either aggressive, balanced, or defensive in their tactics that campaign phase.
Yeah, I can see how that would work really, really well.
Yeah, it's a fun little system, and I'm definitely looking forward to using it in some of the battle reports on the channel.
Yeah, I think it definitely brings a new element to like the start of the game. You're not just relying on a dice, the strategy, you know, things like that. You could try to think, right, would my opponent, like, get in this ahead of your opponent as well, be like, are they going to play, have they got a defensive army, are they going to play quite defensive? Would they be quite an aggressive person who's going to go for, like, having that control? It's a nice little, like, mind game element, I think, which is quite, it sounds fun.
So then it's worth mentioning as well that in this book, there is also a series of information for a Pariah Nexus campaign. And essentially, this is just the, again, latest rendition of Games Workshop's 9th/10th edition approach to campaigns. So it breaks down things into forming alliances, having campaign phases that last, you know, 1 week, 2 weeks, whatever, and then having each phase consist of scoring campaign points for winning and losing, drawing games. And those campaign points contribute to your alliance winning strategic points from phase to phase. And then at the end of the campaign, the alliance with the most strategic points wins the campaign. And in addition, there is a little table of alliance upgrades. So each campaign phase, the alliances pick an upgrade for their alliance to benefit from. It's all pretty standard stuff now that we've seen before, but we've seen it before because it's really good. Yes. Like having played this now as well at the Echoes of War event, like I've used this for some of our 2-day events and it's been great. I really think it works really well for an alliance system in campaign play. So again, if that's something you're looking for or would like to try and you don't have any of the previous resources from recent years, this is a place where you can get that. And you can pick it up and you've got it all written out in here, how to run a multi-stage, multiplayer campaign. And it's great. It is also worth noting that it's not dependent on having to use like these missions or the Blackstone Fragment system we'll talk about in a second. Like, there's some extra little stuff in there. Like, one of the alliance upgrades is that each member of your alliance gains 2 additional Blackstone Fragments. Stuff like that, but it's only minimal, you know, so it's easily workable without having to go all in on every Crusade mechanic in here. You could just use this for a campaign that is a non-Crusade campaign and it'll work perfectly fine.
I mean, that's good to know when you've got modularity in your game system, that means you can tailor the experience to what you want. If you're fairly new to Crusade as well, then there can be a lot to get your head around at times, can't there? So just adding little bits here and there and might be useful.
Yeah. Like I say, I think, as with a lot of things in 40K game design, I think starting with some of the system in place and not all of it, and then getting used to it bit by bit and adding layer and layer until you get to the point where it's all second nature and you can do all 10, 15, 20 things that you need to be doing at once, is the way to do it. Just start with two or three of them, you know, and work your way up. And this is a good way of doing that. If you want to play your first campaign, it doesn't have to be a Crusade one. If you want to play Crusade, it doesn't have to be a campaign. Like, they're two separate modules. You can use them together. They are designed to work together, but they also work independently. So it's a good resource.
Yeah, I really like that. Like I said, because I think with starting a new kind of personal campaign where we probably may not use Crusade rules, but we may add something to it. So I think picking up this book and maybe even just having a campaign structure for that would be quite handy for it not to get a bit too like muddled and confusing.
Another thing worth mentioning is that this book does include an updated version of the Crusade Blessings system, which is the underdog system. So it's something which I feel isn't, as far as I'm aware, isn't often used or needed by a lot of people, because typically if you are playing Crusade, you're probably playing with a group of friends in a roughly equivalent sort of growth of campaign. So there's usually not a huge amount of disparity between the armies. But if you are in a position where you've got a Crusade army that has a lower Crusade value than your opponents, then in 9th edition, all you got for that really was a couple of extra command points. And it was something, but it wasn't the most in-depth solution. Whereas the Crusade Blessings in here is a whole series of upgrades and abilities that you can use to enhance your force or your characters or whatever in multiple ways, more so than just some extra command points. You got things like the ability to take prepared positions. So like any of your units in your deployment zone get the benefit of cover, regardless of where they are. You can improve the leadership characteristics of models in your Crusade army while they're part of an attached unit. You can gain extra Blackstone fragments in this Blackstone campaign system. You can feel no pain against psychic attacks because you've got psychic shielding. You can add plus one move to character and infantry and walker units in your army. And then there's extra things to gain, like extra XP and so on, for units that do survive the battle and stuff like that. So there's a few more options there than just extra command points. There are some extra command point stuff as well. Like, there's things where you can use some stratagems for zero CP. There's some ones where you just straight up gain some extra CP, but that's if you're choosing it, you know, because it is useful to you.
I do think that is quite an important element as well. So someone who did fall a little behind in the 9th Crusade, I think just having the CP wasn't really something that helped me catch up again, you know what I mean? So I think having those extra elements may just kind of like just being able to gain extra experience or Blackstone just means you can bring just play that catch up a little more, you know?
I mean, even things like
that. It's also more interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, even just getting plus one movement on, like, your whole orc army for a game. Yeah. That's going to be useful.
It also sounds quite strategic to, like, what you, like, having the multiple options. You can go, look, where did I kind of fail in the last game against this army? I can then counter that a little bit and just kind of even the score, especially if they've got a lot of, like, traits that they've got, like, a plus one to hit and you can just kind of, or like a plus one AP, and you can negate that a little bit by giving yourself cover or something. It's quite interesting. Again, another strategic element to bring to it.
Yeah, the one of the options is the Noctilith Augury, which basically means that, so if you're the underdog and this is one of your Crusade Blessings, if you're playing using the strategic footings system we were just talking about, you can change your strategic footing after both players have revealed their choices.
Yeah, and that is a really nice one, isn't it? If you're below the curve with your army, being able to swap it around to get that advantage is massive.
Yeah, you'll be able to probably choose whether or not you get the first turn or not in a lot of missions, and you will be able to guarantee you're the one as a tactical advantage for the game.
Yeah.
Which might hopefully even things out if you are currently in an underdog position.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the last element outside of the missions themselves is the Blackstone fragments. So basically, as we are familiar with now from many a Crusade force and many faction rules, one of the things that Games Workshop does like to provide in their extra layers of Crusade rules is resource management. So,
like resource management.
If you are playing a full Pariah Nexus Crusade campaign, then as you play games, you will have the opportunities to acquire Blackstone fragments. This can be from things like the alliance upgrades, mission rewards and objectives in games can reward with Blackstone fragments. There are a selection of agendas in here, which in addition to earning XP in the way that you do with agendas, you also earn Blackstone fragments based on what you've achieved. And ultimately, it's all to acquire a pool of Blackstone that you can then redeem for one of two things. Either Blackstone Battle Honours or Blackstone Crusade Relics.
Cool.
Following the Battle Honours, you can purchase using Blackstone Fragments. Once purchased, each Battle Honour can only be applied to one character model from your Crusade army. To apply the same Battle Honour to another character, you must purchase it again. You can spend Blackstone Fragments to purchase the unique Crusade Relics below, and each one can only be purchased once. When a character gains a Crusade Relic, you can select one of these Crusade Relics you have purchased for your character to gain. So basically, any time that you would get a Battle Honour or a Crusade Relic, you can choose one of the Blackstone equivalents if you have enough Blackstone fragments to purchase it. So, in the case of the Battle Honours, we've got options for 10, 15, and 20 Blackstone fragments. For 10, we have the Single-Minded Seeker. If the bearer is your warlord, at the end of the battle, roll 1d6, adding 2 to the result if you won the battle. On a 6+, you gain 3 Blackstone fragments. So again, just cycling them more into it, because I think the Blackstone fragments are also used to earn an extra strategic point in the campaign results as well. So I think it was that at the end of every campaign phase, whichever faction has gathered the most fragments that phase also gains an additional point towards the strategic points to win the campaign. So they are also of value to your alliance as a whole.
Okay, makes sense.
You have the 15 Blackstone fragments. Acquisitive Opportunist. At the start of the battle, if the bearer is your warlord, until the end of the battle, it gains the ability below that corresponds with the strategic footing that you selected in the strategic footing step.
Okay.
So if you went aggressive, models in the bearer's unit have the scout 6-inch ability.
Ooh, that's cool.
Mm.
If you went balanced, the bearer has the lone operative ability. And if you went defensive, models in the bearer's unit have the stealth ability.
Yeah, that's nice.
It gives you some nice diversity. Yeah, it gives you some nice diversity as well as to what to do with that character, because the bonus they give out could be different from game to game. For 20 Blackstone fragments, you can get the nodal map. While the bearer is in range of an objective marker, if the bearer's unit is battle shocked, change the objective control characteristic of models in that unit to 1 instead of 0.
That's nice.
Especially if they're going to be leading, you know, some big 20-man units like Black Templar Crusaders or Orc
boys or whatever. Can Chaos Space Marines even come in 20 man units these days or not? I can't remember.
I think it's just 10 now, isn't it?
Is that the max on like cultists as well? Or
20 is cultists, so.
But that's the Battle Honours. And then there is also the relics. It's for 15 Blackstone Fragments. You can get the Empathic Disinclinator.
Ooh. Nobody likes being disinclinated, do they?
This experimental neuroemitter can be energistically entangled with local deposits of Blackstone, causing them to resonate on microfrequencies cogitated to trigger disturbing visual hallucinations amongst the foe. Mm. Enemies so much as looking in that direction have their aim fouled and their blows robbed of strength by the horrors that they see. So you make them suffer from hallucinogenic Blackstone. At the start of the battle, select one objective marker. While the bearer is on the battlefield, friendly units within range of that objective marker have a 5+ inbun save.
Oh, nice.
Yep, that's nice.
For 20 Blackstone Fragments, you have the Noctilith Armament. This is you select one melee weapon equipped by the bearer, excluding a weapon that has been enhanced by an enhancement or a weapon modification. That weapon is now a Crusade Relic. Note this on the Bearer's Crusade card. And give the weapon a suitable name.
That's... Of course.
Once per battle in the fight phase, the Bearer can activate this Crusade Relic. If they do so, until the end of the phase, each time an attack is made with that weapon, invulnerable saves cannot be made against that attack.
Ooh. That's nice.
Yeah. Once per game, activate your Noctilith armament and make your weapon ignoring buns. Very nice.
That is great.
Now, this one specifically is for melee weapons only, so no fancy Noctilith pistols blasting their way through in bunch units, but oh well. And then finally, for 20 fragments, you have the Blackstone Amulet. This soul-sapping parapet may destroy its wearer given time. However, in the short term, it renders even their mere presence baleful. Each time a melee attack is allocated to the bearer on an unmodified saving roll of a 6, the attacking unit suffers one mortal wound after it has finished making its attacks. If that attack was made with a psychic weapon, this effect applies on an unmodified roll of a 5+ instead.
Ooh, nice.
Ooh, yeah.
Nice to see Blackstone affecting the psychic kind of weapons.
Yeah, I'd say there's a few interesting little nods in here to sort of defensive measures against psychic attacks and weapons. So yeah, that's the Blackstone Fragment system. And like I say, there's a bunch of agendas that you can pick in here, which, if you're not familiar, agendas basically are your secondary objectives in Crusade. They typically reward experience to the units that achieve them, but in this case, they also reward some Blackstone Fragments for certain ones. For example, the agenda to the last. At the start of the battle, you can select up to 3 units from your Crusade army that are on the battlefield. And for each one of those units at the end of the battle, if that unit was not destroyed, it gains 2 XP. If it was not below half strength, it gains an additional XP. And for each of those units that is not destroyed, you gain 1 Blackstone Fragment.
Okay, that's nice.
Yeah, and there's basically a whole bunch of these which are like typical agendas for Crusade, but with that additional clause of you also potentially gain some Blackstone.
Again, that's another nice kind of like strategic element that you go, look, I know this unit is going to die. I'm probably not going to put it on them. I'll put it on the more tanky unit. And then you can try to like really gain that extra XP and Blackstone by investing in those units. Might even play them more defensively based on that element as well.
Yeah, and you've got ones like Kingslayer that's obviously gain XP for killing enemy characters, but you also get a Blackstone Fragment for each character that you kill, and like an extra one if it's the Warlord.
Oh, nice.
Mm. Yeah, that is good.
And then there is also actually There's three extra agendas as well, one of which is available for each of the strategic stances. So there is first into the fray if you're in aggressive stance, calculate destruction if you're in balanced, and hold steady if you're in defensive. So again, they have their own things to do, and they reward XP and Blackstone fragments to various units. But the, again, that strategic stance choice gives you, opens up a certain option for you here.
Yeah, I mean, that really does seem to give you a lot of options to the way to play a battle now, doesn't it? Right, yeah. from the word go. So, I mean, it's nice, yeah. It changes it up quite a bit, I would say, considering...
Yeah, well, so for example, the first into the fray agenda, if you're in the aggressive stance, at the end of the first battle round, select the three units from your Crusade army that are within engagement range of one or more enemy units. The selected units gain 2 XP and you gain 1 Blackstone fragment for each unit selected.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. That's at the end of the first battle round.
Yes, and that's it. That's the only time it checks. So, like, right. That is going to dictate your battle plan, you know, certainly at the start of the game. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that really adds a different element to, like, you're making those choices. It's not just about being attacker defender now. It's, you know what I mean? It's like, if you want to be a melee, you really want to win that kind of, like, the attacker role to gain that extra...
Yeah, like, the defensive one is hold steady, and this is at the end of the battle, if at least half of your Crusade army's units are not destroyed, you can select up to 3 of them that were not destroyed, and those units each gain 2 XP, and you gain 3 Blackstone fragments. So again, playing an entire battle plan, like an entire game, where one of your objectives is to keep at least half of your units alive, is going to dictate some of your plans and, you know, maneuvers during the game.
Yeah, and I really like that because, as you said, these are like your secondary objectives, but the mission will usually have some primary objectives, obviously. And having an agenda like that where you're having to keep stuff as far away as possible and as safe as possible probably doesn't necessarily play into what the primary mission is in the whichever... mission that you're choosing, and so you've got some real difficult choices to make there. Are you going to try and win the game, or are you going to try and keep your army alive because you want that XP and those Blackstone fragments at the end?
Yeah, and like I say, some of the missions as well have some interesting mechanics to work around with trying to make those decisions. Like, for example, there's one of them called the Dig Site Raid, which basically, it's kind of like a mini Get the Relic mission, where there's 5 objective markers, but each one of them represents some Blackstone. So when you have a character model get in range of them, they pick it up, and then they have it in their possession. But if they get killed, they drop it.
Right.
And like the scoring for that one, so I'll just run through this one quickly. So basically, there's like 5 objective markers. 3 of them start in no man's land, and 2 of them start like on the line of your deployment line.
Yeah.
And this is it's like short table edges, but sort of like a triangle corner of the short table edge. So Blackstone collecting. At the start of the battle, each marker on the battlefield contains 1 fragment. At the start of your turn, if a character model from your army is in range of an objective marker you control that contains a Blackstone fragment, that model can collect it. If it does so, that model takes possession of the fragment, and the objective marker no longer contains a fragment. Then you've got raiding their cache. If a character model in possession of a Blackstone fragment is destroyed, place a marker as close as possible to where that model was destroyed. For the purposes of Blackstone collecting, that marker now counts as an objective marker containing 1 fragment, but does not count as an objective marker for any of the rules purposes.
Right.
So again, you can pick them up. The scoring for this is at the end of each command phase, the player whose turn it is scores 5 victory points for each of the following conditions they satisfy. They control 1 or more markers, which is the initial 5, which they will stay in place even once Blackstone's been like pulled out of them. And they control more objective markers than their opponent. 5 points for each of those. But then end game scoring, you've got Blackstone Extraction. At the end of the battle, each player scores 10 victory points for each Blackstone fragment possessed by a character model from their army. In addition, for each of those fragments, that player's Crusade Force gains one Blackstone fragment. So there's potentially 50 victory points lying around on the table.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And then for this mission, like the victor bonus, if you're playing Crusade or a campaign and you've got these linked resources, you select one unit that collected one or more Blackstone fragments during the battle, and that unit gains D3 plus 3 experience. So it's quite a reward for one of the units that managed it.
I mean, that mission just sounds great, even just on a standalone basis, doesn't it?
Yeah. And if you're using strategic footings, the advantage to the player who has it is that once per battle, you can target a character unit in your army with the epic challenge stratagem for 0 CP.
Nice.
Ah, okay. Yes. So you can try and kill their character.
And take the Blackstone. Yes. Yeah. That's real nice.
Yeah.
I fairly recently went to Element Games and played at a Winters SEO like narrative tournament.
Yeah.
And there was
Archer Winters.
Yeah, yeah, that was
I was meant to be there, but I got COVID.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a mission in that. I think it was the first one, and it was like a capture the cat, and there was a cat marker on the thing, and when your characters could grab that, and then they would then come for that character to take it off them, and it was really nice kind of like holding a marker with your character and it moving around with you. So I think bringing that element to it as well, there'd been this like another reason to take down a character, you know, and steal from them. I really like that. As plain admission, a very simple version of that. It really interesting.
There's one mission that I particularly like, I want to shout out, called Outflank. And it's because this has some interesting deployment maps, which is always, I think, a good hallmark of a good mission.
Yeah.
So just for Sharpie and Darren right now, you can see what this deployment map looks like.
Oh dear, heavens. Right.
And to just describe it to our listeners, essentially it's like table quarters with two triangle edges, so like two small triangles in opposite corners for, you know, attacker defender, but the opposite two corners in what you would call the strip of no man's land also has a small sort of square deployment rectangle zone for the attacker on both flanks. And then in the center of no man's land, there is a larger square area for the defender. Now, the reason why there's so much deployment zone is because actually this is two different deployment zones overlaid, like two different deployment maps. So you only end up playing with either the triangle corners or the center square with the two flanking squares.
Okay.
But it's determined in the mission as to which deployment you're going to be using. So this is... So the deployment map is chosen essentially by the player with advantage.
Nice.
Right.
So this is... you can select which deployment maps will be used for this mission. Either those marked A, which is the triangle corners, or those marked B, which is the squares flanking no man's land.
Yeah.
If you select B, the attacker must set up at least one third of their army's units in each of the two deployment zones. And the defender always has the first turn. So the one where the defender is in the middle of the table.
Yeah.
If neither player has advantage, use zones marked A. So based on that little matrix of outcomes, if neither player has advantage, then you meet in a pitched battle and you appear in two corners and your armies charge at each other. But if there is a player with advantage, then the defender will start in the middle and the attacker will start on the flanks, about to dive on them. But the defender will get the first turn. So like a first opening volley as the attackers approach.
And then additionally, there's flanking strike, which is the defender cannot place any units in strategic reserves or reserves, excluding units that must always be placed in reserves, such as aircraft or drop pods. Yeah. So your whole army is sort of committed to the defense of that defensive position. Then in either case, depending on how you're deploying, there's 5 objective markers, 1 in the center of the table, and then 4 sort of 1 in each table quarter. At the end of each command phase, the player whose turn it is scores 5 victory points for controlling 1 or more objective markers and controlling more objective markers than the opponent. There is also a critical objective, which is an endgame objective. At the end of the battle, the player who controls the objective marker at the center of the battlefield scores 20 victory points. So, yeah, if you've got the advantage and you are the defender, then the critical objective is going to start in the middle of your army.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like it's telling a story right there. You know, like that game is going to be, it's going to have a natural unfolding narrative to it from that point onwards.
And again, that little decision at the start of the game about, you know, whether you want to go aggressive or you want to be defensive, if you get that right, then you're going to get a massive advantage in that game.
Yeah.
If you get it wrong, then it might be a bit of an uphill battle.
I do think as well, sometimes just having an uneven deployment can really make a game feel more narrative as well. So like for this, like obviously they're being attacked from both sides. You can write that a lot into a story, you know.
I can give you a perfect example of this one, Darren. So one of the next missions of interest is the Interdimensional Clash. And again, for Sharpie and Darren's benefit, you can quickly see the deployment map here.
The attacker have got a fair amount of space.
Yep. So again, just to describe it for listeners, basically, it's short table edges, but the attacker has 50% of the table. So right up to the midline of the board is the attacker's deployment zone. And there is only a 12-inch no man's land between the front of their line and the front of the defender's potential deployment zone. But there are 4 objective markers on the table. 3 of them are in the defender's deployment zone. And then 1 of them is like on the front and center of the attacker's deployment zone. So that, like you say, Darren, is an example of it's an uneven deployment zone because it is telling a story. Like the defender is obviously about to bear the brunt of this, you know, charge, this offensive maneuver, but also they hold all the key objectives at the start of the game.
Yeah, I love that element. And I can really see what they're trying to do as well in just trying to like take this away from like competitive play where everything's mirrored, everyone's got the same. And it adds that extra element of fluff. You know, I mean, you can really imagine these like bunkering down, like we need to hold these objectives. We don't have much room. There's a horde in front of us. They're all coming at us. They hold the board. These are ours. We will defend them with our lives. And I think like just from that, that's a story.
Yeah. And like those are the games where if you know you're playing that mission, you also set your terrain up, don't you? So, you know, I can think of, like, I've got some bunkers and some defensive line terrain. That's clearly going to go into the defender's deployment zone to give them that little bit of an advantage in that respect. You know, like you say, you're not getting your L-shaped ruins symmetrically placed on both sides of the battlefields in that one. You're creating something much more narrative, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, this mission does actually include a designer's note that says, we recommend placing a higher volume of terrain, such as ruins, in no man's land and the defender's deployment zone to represent a tight, close quarters battlefield.
Yeah,
I like that. That reminds me, I've played a game quite similar before where I think we had an uneven deployment and I put all my orcs in the big open space like that. And we said basically it was the desert and then we made a city on the edge and it was the orcs invading the line of the city, the first bit of the city. So I can imagine that would play well into that kind of like narrative.
Yeah, and that
is all the a discussion and a narrative told just from the deployment and the objectives. Like, the scoring for this mission is really simple. It's just every command phase, 5 victory points for holding one or more and more than the opponent, which obviously in the early game is going to be leaned towards the defender because they have them all. But then the mission rule for this mission is danger close, which is simply when resolving the deadly demise ability of units, increase its range by 3 inches and add 1 to the roll.
Okay, wow. So it goes off in fives and...
And it's a 3-inch larger radius. It's a 9-inch bubble.
Yeah, wow. you're taking a lot of tanks as a defender, you're in trouble, aren't you?
Yep. And then, can you guess what the advantage might be for the player who has advantage in this mission?
Ooh, I mean, there must be some advantage to mitigate how fast they get. Something to do with shooting. Do they get +1 to hit if they don't move or something?
Not quite, but I think you were on the right lines of something to do with how fast the opponent gets to you. The advantage is, if you are the attacker and you have advantage, you extend your deployment zone by an additional 3 inches towards your opponent's battlefield edge.
Amazing. So they're only 9 inches away.
Yes.
Wow.
Or if you are the defender and you have advantage, you reduce the attacker's deployment zone by 6 inches towards their battlefield edge.
Yeah.
So if you are defending,
really,
you have advantage.
Want to win that one, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You have you're looking at the difference between an 18-inch no man's land or a 9-inch no man's land, depending on who wins advantage.
Yeah.
That sounds very fun.
Yeah, it's genuinely a really interesting system. When obviously applied with these advantage rules across these missions, there's a bunch of interesting scenarios that come out of it.
I think the other thing it does as well is it, because obviously if you play the same mission 3 times from this book, it's never going to be the same mission because you're going to have different deployment zones based on if you win or lose as well.
Well, I also think that different armies will play very differently in the attack or defender role there. So if you played it with a buddy, I don't know, if I took my Necrons and you took your Orcs and you played the attacker as the Orcs and I played the defenders as the Necrons, okay? I mean, I suspect that might be a little bit more balanced than if it was the other way around. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you had the Orcs as the defenders and the Necrons as the attackers, I mean, I don't know. You'd get a completely different game, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you really would.
And then another difference to that is if it's the Orcs defending but you win and you reduce the... And if you're an Orc defending and you lose, again, it's just another game.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's almost got that element that people like about the Leviathan mission deck where, you know, the scoring is different every game because it depends on what order you draw the secondaries in and stuff. Well, these missions, despite having set parameters, they also have a variable aspect to them based on these attacker-defender roles.
Yeah.
Which gives them, like you say, multiple different plays out of them that will feel like very different games. Yeah, I think... It's good. I think it's worth picking up. And honestly, for people like, you know, like myself, where I'm very invested in this game, I play it a lot. I pick up basically all the sort of like books outside of every codex for every army. You know, like I'll pick up all the supplements and the expansions and the crusade rules and stuff like that. For someone like me, it's great just for the missions, let alone everything else that you're getting there. And for anyone who doesn't already have copies of things like the campaign system or the crusade rules, or you have a playgroup and you're wanting to start your own crusades for the first time, you know, this is great for that. I do think this is a good book to pick up. Like, you don't need an individual copy for everyone. If you've got a club or a group of friends, you can get like a club copy and it'll be great for that.
Yeah, I think even just from listening to this already, like just the little bits that we've like snippeted out the book, I'm like, I'm already convinced I'm going to buy this book at some point.
And I have not even read all the lore yet, and I'm sure there's going to be some very entertaining stuff in there to make an interesting lore quiz out of. Yeah, it's good. I'm enjoying these Crusade books, and I'm looking forward to more of them as the edition goes on.
Yeah, me too. Like I said, I'm definitely sold on that book. I think it's got a lot to offer and a lot of variety, and keep it kind of fresh. And as I said, someone who's been playing quite competitive at the minute, I'm wanting that other element to bring like a lot more narrative. And
yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily easy to get into a Crusade campaign, but that book just brings some nice missions that just change things up a bit in case you'd want to put the Leviathan deck down.
Mm.
I mean, I think they've got the Leviathan deck pretty good this time, after a couple of iterations over the last couple of editions, but you know, there's still a random element to that, and you know, that's designed to be balanced, and you don't always want a balanced game. Sometimes you want something that feels, you know, like you're putting an army on the table and you're fighting against odds. So even if it's just picking it up for the different missions, I think I'm probably going to have a look at it.
And I think the most interesting development out of it is the strategic footings system.
Yeah, like, I really like that.
It's not often I feel that we see something that is relatively completely original within the context of, you know, Warhammer 40,000. And yeah, I think this is something that is pretty original as a game system within it.
I think did the last edition of Kill Team, did that used to have like a little mini game at the start where you, I mean, I might be wrong, because I didn't play it very often, but I seem to recall there was a little bit of you chose a role and they chose a role, and depending on which role you chose, something might happen. But certainly from a 40K point of view, this is, you know, just that starting point of, well, if I choose this, you know, it might work out for me, but then actually it might not work out for me. I mean, I think that adds a different element to the start of the game, adds a bit of interest. I mean, those people that are super competitive probably won't like the, you know, the idea of that, but...
Well, I think it could actually make a really interesting strategic decision for players playing a competitive match where, say, it's a Leviathan deck, you know, standard sort of approach to a game, but something about the mission role or the scoring has a minor, you know, advantage for whichever player has advantage. But also, could you imagine if the Leviathan secondary cards all had an additional condition on them where area denial would be worth an extra victory point if you were in balanced stance? Behind enemy lines would be worth an additional victory point if you were in aggressive stance.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Like, it would make for a really interesting dynamic.
Yeah. I'm going to say at the beginning when you went over the strategic stances, I was like, oh yeah, it's whether it's attacker or defender, it's fun, but it's not much different from kind of rolling a dice a little bit. But I think all the elements that it affects throughout the missions, the secondaries, the choices that it makes, the deployment, I think it's like a great, great element they've added. I really like it as a new thing they've brought to it.
Yeah, it's definitely something I'll be considering including as a system or mechanic in some of my future events, possibly.
Yeah.
And coming up with perhaps a couple of like optional mission advantages that I can apply to missions outside of this book, you know, because I mean, there's some of them just in here that's like, one of the advantage is you can have a unit gain infiltrate that doesn't normally have infiltrate.
Yeah.
One of them is like, you can have a unit use the rapid insertion stratagem for zero CP.
Mm-hmm. That's really, okay, that's really good.
Yeah,
stuff that could be applied in a relatively generic situation. It doesn't have to be. I can choose whether or not the deployment zone is 6 inches larger or smaller, or I can choose which of the objectives do and don't activate this turn. Like, they're a bit more like wedded to that mission, but there are some that are more sort of just generic advantage. It's just like a little bonus. So you could put that on some missions that are in other, you know, sources like the Tyrannic Warbook.
Yeah. I think there was something you said as well. I think I might be wrong. I think it was when you talked about maybe one of the Blackstone relics, and it would like, if you won, one of your units gained scout. Whoever held it gained scout. And then, like, as someone like obviously playing orcs, is like the only way you can get scout with orcs is by putting Zodrog with Grots. And that's the only way you can get scout in the game. Whereas, like, now you maybe add it to, say, a war boss with five knobs, and they get to just move forward. And I think just mixing up the core element of what a single unit can do, and you can now kind of get a new element, like a new strategic element with that unit, that's great.
I can tell you the one, yeah, so the relic in question is the one where, depending on the stance, either the unit you join gains scout, the bearer himself has lone operative, or the unit he joins has stealth. And there'll be certain units in certain codexes that will have the flexibility to make use of all three of those. And I can tell you the orc one would be the Deathkiller Warthrike.
Yeah.
Because either scout moving with his bikes, giving his bikes stealth, or even having lone op for a game, he just doesn't need to join the bikes. He can actually just roam around by himself for once.
Yeah, that's cool.
And there'll be certain characters in certain codexes that will have that tactical flexibility to sort of really make use of those strategic things. So yeah, I mean, I think that's about everything for tonight. It's fair to say that we like this book. We're going to get plenty of use out of it, and I think you could too. I do recommend picking it up if you're looking for some extra narrative missions, some interesting games, or as I say, just expansions on Crusade, or generally a campaign system. It's all in there. It's a good pickup. So all that's left then really is just to wrap everything up for tonight. So first of all, where can people find you both out there on the internet? Sharpie, do you know it off by heart now?
Yeah, so you'll just find me on Instagram. I'm sharp0608. That's sharp with an E. It's just a hobby account. You'll see pictures of the games that I've played recently. I'm a big fan of, you know, nicely painted armies, nice tables set up, and then there'll be some pictures of units I've painted, and just recently lots of Blood Bowl stuff, because that's what I've been playing a fair bit recently as well.
And Darren, how about yourself? Where can people find many, many wonderful pictures of Bad Moon Orcs?
it's Orc Daggers on Instagram, but it's Daggers with AZ at the end, because obviously it's Orky. And yeah, that's the one. Not really been working on much at the minute, really, but I've got a couple of conversions I'm going to probably be posting on there soon that I'm going to be working on.
I look forward to seeing them. And then, as always, you can find myself at Narrative Wargamer on basically all the platforms that I'm on. That includes Instagram, Facebook, we have a Discord channel as well. Links for everything, and including our social accounts, will be in the description below. And yeah, it's always worth noting as well that we do have a Patreon. So if you do enjoy the show and you want to help support us, you can go support us there. It's really appreciated, and it really does help with the costs of running the show and the YouTube channel. And to say a big thank you always to our patrons, because they really have helped get us to where we are today. But also, if you do want to support the show for free, you can do so by using our affiliate links below. So if you do want to pick up a copy of Prior Nexus, or just generally whatever your next hobby purchases are, if you go to Element Games via our affiliate link in the description, then that will also give us a little kickback and help support us that way as well. And it doesn't cost you anything. So yeah, always really helpful. And of course, you can like and subscribe to us here on YouTube. It does help. It helps push the videos out to everyone else, and it really helps promote us in the algorithm. And we are starting to see slowly rising numbers for subscribers and views, and that is great to see. So yeah,
As always, like and subscribe. It really does genuinely help us out. And yeah, until next time, guys, when hopefully we might be back with some very interesting fun facts. This has been the Narrative Wargamer Podcast, helping you to discover more ways to play 40k.